Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Our podcast today is brought to you by the folks at 8 Sleep. And of course, you can subscribe to us anywhere where they have fine or at least acceptable podcasts. And our guest today, given everything that's going on, is really appropriate. We've really been pretty lucky in getting people, slotting people in, you know, just when they have the most relevance to the news cycle. So, of course, we're inviting back Benjamin Wittes, the CEO of Lawfare. Well, you're the editor-in-chief of Lawfare, right? The editor-in-chief of Lawfare. So I'm sitting here, and before we get into what I wanted to talk to you about, I'm just looking at the stock market. I'm looking at the stuff about the trade war, and we're not going to get into that in deep. But you know, James Holman over at the Washington Post tweets out that three of the five economic indicators which most closely track the business cycle are now at levels consistent with the start of a recession: auto sales, industrial production, and aggregate hours work. And I think what's really freaking people out is the complete uncertainty of what the president is doing with the economy from moment to moment. So yesterday, he came down and he saved Christmas. He actually saved Christmas by delaying all those tariffs on the stuff that we would buy around the Christmas buying season. But of course, that caused him to acknowledge that, yes, in fact, American consumers are paying those tariffs, which, you know, is a somewhat different message than we'd heard that the Chinese were paying the tariffs. And then there's this whole question of like, well, did he just blink? I mean, Wilbur Ross, I don't know if you saw it, Ben, but I mean, Wilbur Ross is asked, well, did we get anything for this quid pro quo? And he goes, yeah, not really. So here's this moment where he kind of just shows his hand and says, yeah, I'm going to cave. it's where are we going to go on this? You know, and it's so because he fights, right?
I mean, the answer to that is, of course, we don't know, except for one big thing I think that we do know, which is that, you know, this is any time you probably always want the president to be injecting stability into the markets, right? But certainly at a time when you are worried about whether we are on the precipice of some significant economic change for the worse, that is a good time for presidents to be consistent and cool-headed and not shift radically from position to position and not do things all of a sudden that are going to erode confidence. And of course, to list those things is to list negative character attributes of the current president. And so, you know, it is exactly at a moment like this that you want somebody who would say, you know, look, a lot of people have a lot of criticism of George W. Bush in the latter few months of his presidency when the economy, when the economic crisis hit. But, like, you know, he did not do anything with his rhetoric to make that situation worse, right? And you know, without getting into whether the way he handled it was good or bad or whether he bears some responsibility for the crisis developing in the first place, if you just think about his rhetoric at the time, he was a steady hand and worked TARP through with Obama's support as then the candidate. And they projected both the late Bush administration and the early Obama administration projected a sort of continuity of policy. And that is exactly what you want in a period when things are very uncertain. And that is, of course, exactly what you can never expect from Donald Trump.
And the most dangerous pattern, of course, is being completely unpredictable and people miscalculating. So, you know, the president has been, pushing the line that these trade wars were easy to win, that the Chinese would back down, that he would cave, you know, that they would feel too much pain. And then suddenly, without any warning, it is the president who backs down. I think James Pethakokis has a very interesting piece in The Week. Trump just showed his hand in the trade war. And let me read you a paragraph. There must be smiles all around the northern Chinese resort town of whatever on the Yellow Sea where China's leaders are summering. Trump can claim the holiday delay is also an olive branch to the communist vacationers, but that's unlikely to fool anyone other than Fox News diehards. After all, Beijing has likely been counting on the Trump administration having a low threshold for just the sort of economic and political pain that's inevitable from a major trade conflict. Okay, let's segue to one of the other consequences, which is that you know, these storm clouds are gathering and darkening over Hong Kong. These protests have become, very contentious. They've turned violent. The Chinese government has made it, has signaled quite overtly that it is actively considering a major military police crackdown. And it's sort of interesting at this very moment that Trump would show this unwillingness to confront China. So, Ben, let's talk about what the Chinese protests mean. It started off over a, it seemed like a relatively obscure piece of legislation allowing the extradition of, you know, of criminal defendants to mainland China. But it seems to have morphed into something much bigger.
Yeah, I would say it was never really about the extradition bill. The extradition bill was the precipitating event and the flashpoint for it. But these protests are have always been about whether Hong Kong preserves any or how much functional autonomy and whether residents of Hong Kong preserve any degree of freedom that is a creature of their system rather than a creature of the system of mainland China. And the creeping answer to those questions over a long period of time now has been no, and that China has, you know, slowly but surely consolidated control in a fashion that is quite detrimental to the individual liberty of people who live in Hong Kong. And the people who live in Hong Kong have been, you know, remarkably persistent about asserting the illegitimacy of that and insisting that they do want to retain something like liberalism in their governance. And it is one of the, you know, in a world that has seen a lot of populist, anti-democratic, authoritarian movements arise and come to power from, you know, Poland to Hungary to Brazil. You know, you see this all over the place. Hong Kong is a remarkable counterexample. This is a group of citizens who are standing up to one of the most violently authoritarian, powerful governments in the world. And they're doing it without a great deal of chance of success. You know, it should be the kind of thing that A, warms everybody's heart, and B, makes us focus on you know, the basic principle that freedom is not free.
Well, there have been some remarkable scenes that do warm the heart, including the ways these protesters are waving the American flag, you know, and singing the Star Spangled Banner, because it a reminder of what a beacon of hope the United States still is, except that the flip side of that is they appear to have more faith in American support for freedom around the world than may be warranted, because at this moment where everything is on a knife's edge, what messages are we sending? I mean, a few weeks ago, it certainly sounded to me, or then others interpret some of the comments that President Trump made as essentially saying, yeah, you know, both sides here hope that they resolve it and kind of almost green lighting Chinese intervention in Hong Kong. I mean, the United States is not drawing a bright red line for the Chinese oligarchs, do not mess with Hong Kong. There's none of that coming from this administration.
Right. And I think, you know, it is worth distinguishing here between two forms of drawing a bright red line. Like, one is, could we do anything about it? And the answer is no, in the sense that, you know, unlike, for example, a NATO country, right, where we say, if you intervene in the affairs of a NATO country, we are pledged to use force or whatever to defend that country, and that we consider that an attack on us, right? And even when you go outside of NATO, like to Eastern Ukraine, that principle dissipates pretty quickly. And it turns out we will not use force to prevent Russia from taking over Eastern Ukraine. Hong Kong is, by universal recognition, despite its history, despite its weird relationship, part of China. And it is actually the sovereign territory of China. And so there is no sense in which we are going to get involved in an immediate, in any kind of immediate way in that.
Well, except for escalating the trade war, which again, at this moment where the president essentially acknowledged that he's going to blink. So that takes even that option apparently somewhat off the table.
So let's come to the second area is, and I want to distinguish between these, is will we offer moral support? Will we speak about this as, you know, one of the places in the world where liberty is asserting itself and that we always have an interest in the assertion of liberty against authoritarianism, and we will always support that? Are we going to do that? And the answer under Donald Trump is always no. We don't do it anywhere. And in fact, we talk about the authoritarians with a kind of an envy, you know, whether it's saying he wishes people would, you know, applaud for him like they do for Kim Jong-un, right? Or, and then as a corollary to that principle, that will you talk about it? Will you stand for these people? There's a flip side of that, which is will you make anything in your relationship with a country contingent on them doing stuff? And, you know, the answer in the president's case with respect to China is certainly not. He, you know, there are quite literally hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Uyghurs who are being locked up, by the same Chinese government. And these are, you know, Turkic Muslims in Xinjiang, which is, a province of Western China. You know, we don't seem to care very much. It certainly isn't a part of the way we talk about China. And by the way, that's not a problem that's limited to Donald Trump. It's true of European countries. It's also true of a lot of Democrats who were critical of Donald Trump's policies toward China. There's not a lot of people who are out there talking about the Uyghur situation right now. And so I think we do have a bit of a, you know, a national turn your eyes away from, you know, from the some of the most outrageous ongoing abuses of this Chinese Communist Party government. Hong Kong makes that harder because it is this, you know, formerly British territory where lots of people speak English, that is a major financial center and whose people are kind of educated in a kind of Western framework that we have this, you know, sort of solicitude for. So it's a little bit harder. And they're also protesting in very visible kind of ways that, you know, asking for things that are recognizably like democracy and, you know, having laws that they have some say in. And so I do think it's harder. But I am not holding my breath. I think if they're going to be singing the Star Spangled Banner and waving American flags, it's because of things that people other than the president are doing in support of their actions, not because of the central government.
Exactly. These are all important points. You know, you were mentioning this is one of those, you know, given the march of authoritarianism around the world, this is the counter example. But unfortunately, I keep going back to remembering in the late 80s and 90s where we thought that democracy was on the march around the world, sort of the opposite situation where you had the fall of the Soviet Union and the springtime for, democratic renewal. And people thought that that was going to continue in China with the Tiananmen Square protests. But China essentially said, we are different. We're not going to go the same route of Romania, of Bulgaria, Eastern Germany, and Russia. And they crushed it. And I just remember all the commentary, well, you know, with all of the ramifications for China, how China would become a pariah, how its legitimacy had been destroyed. And of course, they pulled it off and we know what happened afterwards. But this is what makes this moment so interesting now, because I'm reading from the Axios analysis, which I think is right, you know, how dangerous China's choice is. If China repeats Tiananmen Square, the world turns on the regime, at least rhetorically. If they hold back, they look weak, and it worsens Xi's political standing that's already been shaken by a slowing economy. So that's why these words and the pressure, you know, might tip it one way or another, because it's not obvious. There's not an obvious choice for what China is going to do here. There's huge downsides of action.
Agreed. And look, the reason Tiananmen Square worked for the Chinese Communist Party is because they were, having watched what happened in Eastern Europe, they were willing to be brutal. And the question is, are they still, right? And the great fear is that the answer to that question is, duh, of course they are. And that makes you very anxious for these kids and young adults who are, many of whom were not alive at the time of Tiananmen Square. I mean, you and I remember it, but a lot of people don't. And not just in the sense that they don't know it happened, as in mainland China, but even in Hong Kong, they're aware of it. But a lot of these protesters do not actually have a living memory of it because they were children at the time or they weren't even born yet. And, you know, one group that does remember it is the Chinese Communist Party.
They do.
And so, you know, you have to worry that this thing ends very badly for these people.
Well, and that's what...
And you got to remember that even as you support them and that fear for them is part of the support.
No, that's exactly right, which is that analysis that it's dangerous either way for the Chinese, that because if they go in, the world turns against them. Really? Really, would it? And what would the consequences be? Because the Chinese already have the experience of hearing all of this condemnation and everything, and understanding that, you know, they have the long view, that it actually doesn't matter that much. Okay, I want to switch to another topic closer to home, because something rather remarkable has happened in terms of, and we lived through the era, and you and I have talked about this, through an era of huge stories that almost get lost because of this frenetic news cycle we're in. And one of the most dramatic developments seems to have been that Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has announced that the formal impeachment proceedings are about to begin or have begun. Which is it?
Well, I think what he really said was that they are already underway, yeah. Right? That by the way, they've been underway for a while.
Okay, so that's kind of a huge deal, and I want to do a deeper dive into that, because normally, you know, in Earth 2.0, that would be a really, really, really big story that everybody would be talking about. Not having me to ask you, you know, what exactly did he say? Are they really actually doing that? So let's dive into that right after hearing from our sponsors at 8 Sleep. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup, only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Benjamin Wittes of Lawfare. So the House of Representatives has already, or at least Jerry Nadler is telling us, they've already begun impeachment proceedings. What does that mean?
Right. So I think to understand this, you have to go back to the fracture within the Democratic caucus about whether they should have an impeachment inquiry. And as listeners will recall, a lot of Democrats want an impeachment inquiry. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, doesn't want impeachment proceedings because she's concerned about protecting the median Democratic voter who flipped a Republican seat. And there are, 40 seats flipped, and she's got to think about the protection of these new Democratic seats where, in districts that impeachment may not be the most popular thing in the world. And so the compromise that is kind of a de facto compromise that has emerged within the Democratic Party is, okay, conduct the investigation, right? Do aggressive oversight as though you were working toward an impeachment. Just don't call it an impeachment inquiry. And demur whenever anybody says, are you going to have an impeachment investigation? Say we're not there yet, or don't say no, but don't say yes either. So that's the sort of working political compromise. But then something else, there's two other really important factors here. One is that Jerry Nadler, who is the head of the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, clearly wants to impeach the president. And so, and the majority of the Judiciary Committee is with him on that. And so the Judiciary Committee is pushing in a more impeachment-y direction. The second thing that happens, and this is what I think triggers this new posture, is that Pelosi actually wants to go after the grand jury information in the Mueller report. And that we know that this she wants this because the committee sues for to get this material. And by the way, they wouldn't be able to, that would require the speaker's approval. So the question is, once you decide to go after the impeachment, the 6E, the grand jury material in the report, your hand is much, much stronger for technical legal reasons that I can explain if you want. Your hand is much stronger if there is an informal impeachment process than if there's not. And so you have this problem, which is on the one hand, for legal purposes in court, you want there to be an impeachment inquiry because then you get the benefits of that for this litigation, which is ongoing. But on the other hand, you don't want for political purposes to acknowledge that you have a formal inquiry. You don't want to have a vote where you say, now we're going to move toward an impeachment inquiry against the president. And so what emerges is this delicate dance where you basically don't have that vote. You don't authorize an impeachment inquiry, but you start doing what you were the same thing you were doing before and demurring and saying, no, it's not an impeachment process. Now you're saying, yes, it is an impeachment process. And so is it honest? No. Is it straightforward? No. Is it too clever by half? Yes. And I think they may pay a price for that in the litigation, actually.
Okay, really? Okay. Because this is the whole point. I mean, I want to put a pin in this because the point you're making, as a non-lawyer, my understanding is that there are many and very formidable legal protections for the confidentiality of grand jury testimony. And therefore, it is very much an uphill fight for Congress to get that released unless they're in an impeachment proceeding. And the historical precedence for getting grand jury testimony is always in the context or has generally been in the context of impeachment proceedings. Is that correct?
There's one huge precedent for this, which is the D.C. Circuit's decision in the Jaworski roadmap case during Watergate, which, where they approved, the D.C. Circuit approved the transmission of a whole bunch of grand jury information to the House Judiciary Committee. And the basis for that was, well, there's an impeachment investigation. And the impeachment investigation is roughly antecedent to a pre-trial, to a sort of to a trial of some kind, or a judicial proceeding of some kind, i.e. a Senate trial. And so the argument is, well, if you want the benefit of that D.C. Circuit precedent, you need an impeachment investigation. But if you call it an impeachment investigation and pass a resolution saying now we have an impeachment inquiry to get that, then you destroy Nancy Pelosi's delicate dance. And so the idea is, can you make it enough like an impeachment investigation inquiry to get the benefit of that that precedent without fundamentally changing your posture? And that's, I think, what they're trying to do here. Whether it is successful or not, probably it may depend on the specific D.C. Circuit panel that reviews whatever Chief Judge Beryl Howell does on
the initial
petition.
So your concern was that because it does look like it is, if it does look as if they're being too clever by half, that the judges will see that and discount the formal impeachment proceedings as simply a ruse for the purposes of litigation, and that will will hurt the case.
I mean, yes, exactly. My concern is that if you're a D.C. Circuit judge and you look at this and say, you need an impeachment inquiry, and then Congress refuses to take that step but tries to posture itself as though it has taken that step, you might well say, hey, the formalities here matter. And if you won't go through the political process of actually putting your name behind this formally, don't ask us to pretend you've done it for you. And so I think, how the D.C. Circuit looks at it, they may put a lot of weight on the formalistic aspects of this, and they might not even be wrong to do that. And so I think it is a risk on the part of the House. On the other hand, I also have to say, since I don't believe the grand jury information is that important, I don't think it's that big a risk or that big a deal. I do think if you were designing it for litigation purposes, you'd probably want the actual impeachment inquiry resolution.
Well, this is a good segue, because I was wondering about why they think the grand jury information is so crucial for them to make, to take additional steps, considering all of the information that is already there in the Mueller report. The Mueller report, which, I think documents in great detail the president's conduct in obstruction of justice and the nature of the Russian attack. And you have I know you listened in to them. When I was talking to one of your colleagues last week, Quinta Jurassic, I was passing along some of the kudos that I was hearing about the report, the podcast that you folks at Lawfare have put out, which retells the story of the Mueller report. And I guess that just reinforces two things for me. Number one, my frustration that more has not come out of that. I mean, as a reaction. But number two, how much information is there? And that if people will listen to it, and I think this is your goal, right? Was to say, okay, we know you're not going to read the book, but listen to what we already know, this incredible story, this incredible narrative that the American people in Congress have already been presented with. What are you waiting for?
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with you that it is amazing that the substantive contents of the report, that is the Mueller report, are not the subject of almost constant conversation, because they involve a portrait of presidential behavior that is at once incredibly rich and almost mind-bogglingly disturbing. And so what we decided to do at Lawfare was to try to tell this 448-page story in a fashion that didn't require that somebody sit down with a dense legal document, didn't require that you remember a whole lot of names or that you be able to sort of draw a whole lot of connective tissue yourself, but simply required that you be able to be mesmerized by an incredible story. And so the project, which was kind of masterminded by my colleague Susan Hennessy, The idea was, hey, we have this whole genre of podcasts that has developed around narrative storytelling in sort of serial form, kind of most famously pioneered by the podcast Serial, but, you know, done now in lots of sort of true crime settings by lots of other people, as well as non-true crime settings, right? And here we have two just incredible stories, right? One is the story of Russian interference with the 2016 campaign and the Trump campaign's engagement with that interference. And that's, which is to say, volume one of the report is a kind of incredible spy thriller. And to tell that story in a fashion that is a really rigorous explication of what's going on in that document, the story that Bob Mueller told, but is also a really cool spy thriller, right? And to put, to tell that story in a fashion that's true to the report, but that also creates a page turner, in an audio form, obviously metaphorically, that makes you want to listen to episode after episode about it. And then the second component, which we have not done yet because we're doing volume one before we do volume two, is a detective story, right? And it is the story of the president's interactions with the investigation of the first story. And so it's a kind of, you know, if you read it in this format, it's a real kind of film noir detective story. And so our idea was, hey, let's actually do the work of that. By the way, I think the House Judiciary Committee should be doing, and the House Intelligence Committee doing, of illuminating this manuscript and creating out of this manuscript a set of episodes that people actually want to listen to.
Right.
Not because they feel a citizenship obligation to listen to it, not because they are they think they need to be
because
outraged
it's riveting.
By it,
or it's
they
a,
need
it's
to
a hell
out.
Of a story.
Because,
yeah,
exactly. Because it's a hell of a story, and so we're doing this using both the report itself, but also a whole lot of the journalists who broke the stories that the report then fleshes out, as well as experts and people who were actually involved in the underlying episodes.
It is fabulous. This is a real departure for you guys. I mean, this is really – you really upped your game on this one.
Well, we did – I mean, it's funny. It's really different from anything else we've ever done. None of us – you know, we're legal analysts. None of us is got a sort of storytelling background. And so we all sort of decided we wanted to do this. And then we were sort of like, well, how do you do it? You know? And so we teamed up with a really cool podcast production company here in Washington called Goat Rodeo. And we've been kind of working with them to kind of create scripts and kind of do audio engineering of a type that we never do in, you know, the Lawfare podcast and Rational Security are kind of like the Bulwark podcast, yeah, in that we have a studio, we sit in front of microphones, right, we record some stuff, and then we post it. And this is really different because you're talking about kind of layered sound, you're talking about different characters.
It's a documentary. Know, so. I mean, and that this is like the next generation of podcasts. They're becoming documentaries, becoming serials. And you listen to this and you go, somebody's going to make an HBO series. Miniseries out of this, because it is the story, the narrative, the characters, the background, and we all know this. And this is, again, going back to my frustration with Congress. It's like they keep waiting for something else, something else. Well, maybe we'll do something if we get this. Well, look what you have. You just need to have it,
right,
you know, packaged in a way that you will understand it, apparently, or that it will motivate you.
So I agree with that completely, and this actually dovetails with the point I was making earlier that I don't think the 6E, the grand jury information that's redacted, is that important. I think if you listen, so we've released four episodes of this, of the report so far, and we'll release another one on Friday. If you listen to those four, or depending on when you do it, those five episodes, the amount of information available in that report to anybody who cares to spend time with it is immense. It does tell a story, or a series of stories, that those stories tell an extraordinary, paint an extraordinary portrait of the behavior of the president and the people around him. And you don't need one iota more information than is sitting there in black and white in order to think about and evaluate that information. And that's kind of the broad point that I think a reasonable listener, we don't, by the way, have any political commentary of in the report itself. It is simply an account of the story. But if you're asking me, like, what do I think a reasonable reader will take away from it? Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is the story that these committees ought to be telling, and you don't actually need a lot more information than you have, or any more information than you have, in order to tell.
Well, it is fantastic, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. Benjamin Wittes, thank you for coming back. You have been a good friend of this podcast, and I appreciate it very much.
You guys are crushing it, and I am so glad you're doing what you're doing with this podcast.
Well, and thank you. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by 8 Sleep. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.